Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. Today, Hawaii is talking about the tsunami scare. We get the latest from the governor. Many were stuck in a traffic gridlock trying to leave evacuation zones and get to higher ground. Where were you leading up to its expected arrival? Caught in the gridlock in Waikiki or on the freeway or on the side streets, scrambling to get gas or ice just in case? Next month will be 2 years since the Maui wildfires. We check in with the state's new fire marshal to get her thoughts as we mark the anniversary. We meet a bird found on every continent except Australia and Antarctica on this week's Manu Minute. And we celebrate the life and work of musical artist Fiji to mark his passing last week. You're listening to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The tsunami advisory in place for the state of Hawaii was officially canceled this morning. It caps off a whirlwind 12 hours in which residents were advised to hunker down or evacuate from the coastline. One of the strongest earthquakes ever recorded struck off the coast of Russia on Wednesday, prompting tsunami warnings in Japan, Hawaii, and the U.S. West Coast. In downtown Honolulu, tsunami sirens blared and bumper-to-bumper traffic lined the streets. Sue Min and Addie spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender as they were waiting for a bus in Chinatown.
That's my first one, so a little bit frustrating and anxious. I don't know what to prepare. I'm like fully moved out of my apartment right now because I'm almost at the end of lease, so I have nothing that I've prepared that's like empty. I'm very scared.
It's actually my last day in Hawaii today, and I have a plane that takes off tomorrow at 7:30 a.m. I hope I get to leave. But my family that's been here for a while, like, nobody's worried. We're in the safe zone, but close enough to like the extreme tsunami evacuation danger zone. But I've been talking to family about it. Nobody cares, and nobody's really worried. So I'm not particularly worried. I mean, the fact that it is a tsunami is kind of stressful, but it happens all the time. And sure, this could be like the one time that it is really, really bad, but so far I think predictions are looking like even if we do get hit, it's like a meter to 3 meters tall for the wave. And according to my aunts, my uncles, and my father, that's nothing. So I guess we don't have that much to worry about.
Okay, Auntie says it's okay, so it's going to be okay. Thanks for talking to me, guys.
Of course.
Well, it was a little chaotic at the airports and harbors. Alaska Airlines suspended its flights to and from Hawaii, and Kahului Airport closed for the night. Normal flight operations have since resumed, and the U.S. Coast Guard at 7:30 this morning cleared all commercial ports for reopening. Just 2 hours before the projected impact of the first tsunami wave on Wednesday, shoppers at a Honolulu Safeway were filling their carts with bottled water, non-perishables, cans of soup, toiletries, and snacks. HPR's Maddie Bender spoke with Elena about what was in her cart.
I'm just getting some essentials. I just moved into an apartment, so I'm like, everything is bare. So I'm just grabbing, like, you know, things that I can put together real quick, like tuna, bread, peanut butter and jelly. Yeah.
Stocking up. I see water, mayonnaise in your cart, some bread, some tuna, some grape jelly.
Just, you know, hopefully enough to keep me covered for the next couple days, you know. And like I said, we just keep praying and we pray for the best and
just in case.
And that we're covered.
And we also talked to Tanya Scott, who had this to say.
I just have water and cereal, stuff that I already needed. And also adding on more stuff that I don't need.
And how are you feeling?
I feel pretty good. Because if a tsunami hits here, I want to be in the grocery store if a tsunami hits real bad. Because we got everything we need right here in this grocery store. So I'm not in any rush to get back home. Because this is a place I want to be if there's a natural disaster. Is in the grocery store.
And just about an hour ago, we had the opportunity to talk to Governor Josh Green to get the latest across the state.
As of 9 a.m., we dropped the advisory, and damage has been very minimal, in spite of some pretty significant waves, like in Haleiwa. But, you know, we didn't suffer any loss of life or any significant damage. So we're feeling really good. And admittedly, this is a very disruptive kind of event because people ended up in traffic, and it's difficult that way. But the main focus is to get people into a safe place. And that's what we did last night.
It was a bit of a scare, but these things do happen, and we have to have a plan. And I think that just underscored as we have now gotten through on the other side.
Yes, that's right. One of the things about this kind of event is that you actually do have to work the problem. And it's much different than having like a tabletop exercise, which we do a lot and is very helpful, but it's just an abstract moment, a test. This was real. And, you know, when you have an earthquake that's that big, it was an 8.7 magnitude earthquake off of Kamchatka. That could have been a huge wave, could have been a 20 or 30 foot wave, just depending on exactly where the earthquake occurs, which part of the water and the depth that it's at, and whether or not it affects the landmass. You know, you can expect something that big to often kill a lot of people and destroy a lot of homes. So we're lucky. It ended up manifesting with about 3 meter high waves toward Japan, and they did okay, I'm told. But we were worried for a while that we could have had 10 or 12 foot waves that hit all of our island, and that would have certainly harmed a lot of people that are unaware or living on the streets, and it probably would have damaged a lot of homes in the inundation area. So just really grateful, and people, for the most part, I mean, the vast majority of people, I think I said 99.95% of the people took it seriously, and a few people went out toward the ocean, stood out there, and I got to tell you, if this thing had just tipped a little bit differently on the seafloor, they could have been killed by a wave. So it's something we need to work on, because even 5 out of 1,000 people or 10,000 people, we don't want to lose, right? I mean, that would be terrible. So next time, all people should avoid the inundation area.
Well, you know, I was looking out from my lanai, and I saw what looked like a string of lights, a lay of lights, and they were all the mariners, the boaters that went out to sea because of the concern about, you know, damage in the harbors. And so it was reassuring to know that, yeah, that they could come back in safely.
Yeah, it is. And that's one of those challenges, right? So a tsunami's coming. We have to tell people to take your boats out to the water, because otherwise they will get driven into the land and cause, well, destruction of their boats, and they'll hurt people when they hit buildings and what have you. So I'm sure that that's very harrowing for boat owners, and I appreciate them being serious about it. That's a community that really understands their craft and, frankly, I found to be very responsible. So this tsunami experience ended up playing out well for us. You never do know. And we seem to be having quite the string of pretty serious earthquakes over the last couple of years, you know, kind of in the ring of fire. That tells me that we are lucky to be ready, because without this kind of readiness, and Haima did a great job, and the mayors did a fantastic job, everybody in public safety was on their game. Without them, and ultimately even the congressional delegation, even from D.C. were helping, we wouldn't be able to do all that we did in just a couple hours.
As I was keeping up to date on the reports of, you know, the first waves in Japan, you know, Midway, that kind of thing, I just was struck by, you know, we are all connected. You know, this is man versus nature. And, yeah, we're all in this together. And I was flashing back to the terrible tsunami they had in Japan and so many lives lost with people trying to evacuate on the road, trying to get to higher ground.
Right.
And was just hoping that would not be the case here.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that we do, and it's intentional, even though it results in some traffic, and I get it, is that we have a series of alerts. So we plan this out beforehand. We begin with an alert when we know that there is going to be a risk. And then 3 hours out, 2 hours out, 1 hour out, and a half hour out, people know to expect these sirens. And that's a very important kind of reality for us. So yes, some people were in traffic. It was even a little bit challenging for me to get over to the emergency management space, because there was so much traffic, but of course my guys got me over there to do the work. But sure, there's going to be some of that. It's different all the time. When the tsunami comes in the middle of the night, it's different. When it comes in the daytime during work, it's different. If it happens on a weekend, it's different. You know, Mother Nature, I don't think, adjusts for those things. So you just don't know what you're going to get. Sometimes the tsunamis that were tragic, that took a lot of lives, happened in the middle of the night when we didn't yet even have modern siren systems. And if you go way back, I think the biggest one in the nighttime was in 1960 when a 9.5 magnitude earthquake hit Chile or came off of Chile. And at 1 a.m., it killed 61 of our people with a 35-foot wave. And then the other huge one was back in 1946. It was actually on April Fool's Day, and it was no joke. But it happened around 2:30 in the afternoon. But even then, because this was back in 46, we didn't have much in the way of prevention. We had a much less structured telephone system, and that killed 159 people. So, you know, now we have the ability, as you saw last night, to have technology across the ocean here locally. And so it's not a surprise that we were able to keep everybody alive and safe.
Well, what I was thinking was, thank goodness this didn't happen next week when the kids are back to school. I know my neighbor's children go to a charter school, and they were starting school today, and they weren't sure when they woke up. Is there still classes today? I think it's a good reminder for people that we will expect to see more traffic on the road as everybody returns back to the classrooms.
For sure. Everyone's got to be careful. And if I may, we've had too many road fatalities this year. Just there's been people driving too quickly, and traffic fatalities have been higher this year. And it's something that's totally within our control if we make the decision as people to not drive that way. We don't have more people living here, really. We have about the same number of travelers, but there have been more car crashes. Some of it's just terrible, heartbreaking, bad luck, and some of it is that we're not being careful enough. So, yeah, during school hours, be super safe. And this particular evacuation, we did kind of time for right after school was out, so it didn't completely upset everyone's life. But I'm just grateful for people taking this seriously for the most part. And we tease that people that go buy a lot of extra, like, toilet paper and stuff, which is cool, but definitely continue to take these warnings seriously, and we're bound to have some more. So we'll be here ready to, you know, respond if anything bad happens.
We are still in hurricane season. And we had a couple of storms forming, you know, out in the Pacific. So just to be mindful of all these things and the possible threats, and to be prepared and to watch out for one another, you know, because it's not just the fatalities with all the crashes. Lots of people are being sent to the hospitals, and, you know, the demand for blood and the strain on the emergency rooms are a concern for all of us across the state.
Of course. Yeah. It's an ever-present challenge. But people in Hawaii have a special keenness for these challenges, and it's yet another one of those things that makes us special. So I'm glad to get to do this job, but really the job gets done because people are thoughtful about how we treat each other during crises, and this was one.
Well, we hope that things are getting back to normal at the airports and in our harbors and back on our roadways. But thank you so much for your time, Governor, this morning.
It's my pleasure. Take care.
And that was Governor Josh Green, who spoke with us this morning about getting through yesterday's tsunami scare.
If the 20th century was the American century, many say the 21st century may belong to China. But what if China's rise to dominance has been fueled by one specific U.S. company?
How did they go from such poverty 50 years ago into the world's greatest maker of, like, military weaponry and advanced electronics? Year in, year out, Apple taught them.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
Next month will mark 2 years since the Maui wildfires roared through Lahaina Town and parts of upcountry Kula. One of the recommendations that came out of that tragedy was the need for a state fire marshal. Dori Booth has been on the job now for about 2 months. She came to us. She was a firefighter in Arizona. Booth is a third-generation firefighter and an Army veteran who served in Iraq, Kuwait, and Afghanistan. We sat down with her in a mostly empty office yesterday afternoon. She doesn't have much furniture or staff at this point. Most of her time has been spent out in the field, learning her new territory.
It's been enlightening. Nobody hears about what Hawaii is doing until there's a tragedy similar to Lahaina, and getting to see firsthand that there's so many amazing initiatives that are going on, not only on the wildfire front, but children's education and outreach, different codes and standards, the people that are all working together to really make small communities, even though we're separated by water, work together in the events of emergency. I think some of the key takeaways for me is that there really is a lot of things that are going on here. Teamwork, there's collaboration, and they all want to do good. And one of my goals from here is, because everybody, you know, as I'm learning in Hawaii, both at the professional and the personal level, it is truly about taking care of each other and who you know and making those phone calls in an emergency of, hey, can I get this? Can you help me out? And when those people change or retire and those relationships change, but what they were doing was great, now we're trying to work to get those memorialized, whether it's MOUs, contracts. And so if something does happen, we can continue those missions and grow them in a formal fashion also, not to take away from the tradition of phoning friends and really making it work quickly, but at least then there's documentation to help move those along if those people are out of town or things get changed up.
And then you have a background with the Army, and when we have seen over the years so many fires, and we help each other out. The federal firefighters come and help the county and vice versa. Talk about those relationships.
So I've not got to meet with a lot of the federal fire people yet. In a couple of meetings, they've been present, but one of my first encounters with them here on island was at the Nanakuli fire. We were actually over at the Maile fire walking through with one of Honolulu's investigators when that fire started, and watching everybody come together, whether it was aviation assets and even on the ground, there were people from our state ARF group, federal fire, both their apparatus as well as their aircraft were in place. So everybody does work together, National Guard as well. So General Logan and I have created a good relationship, the governor and him working on the contract to have National Guard aviation assets on standby for the peak season right now is a game changer too, being able to get air assets up in the air quickly, especially if our other fire helicopters are out on rescues or other missions.
Can you talk about your experience there in Arizona? Because, Arizona is very hot and dry, and it's like, well, what can we learn from your experience with the fire department over there?
So experience in Arizona, I was with Phoenix Fire for 17 years in a very largely urban area with mountain preserves that were very dry. And then we also had people expanding the built environment into that interface and intermix area where we were seeing those brush fires starting to encroach as well into the homes. So working with the Wildland Urban Interface Code and education even to help people understand landscaping and what they can do at their parcel level, but also on a government and land manager side of making sure the right people are talking and communicating and trying to educate our zoners and planners that push back when there is that urgency to build. So we look at affordable housing and the lack of housing for the masses, but when we rush to build and put them in places where maybe there's not road capacity to be able to evacuate them properly or to be absorbed into the community that's already there, making sure that we're sticking to current codes that have literally been developed because of the loss of life and damages in past catastrophes, and that's what we've learned from. So as we're going through there, and thankfully Phoenix was pretty much on the forefront of trying to stick to the standards, but there's a national threat to codes and standards right now that even though a local body or an authority jurisdiction is adopting a model code, so something that's a consensus-based or technically sound in what it is, they're using legislation to bypass those requirements now, such as one of them that's going through fire sprinklers. There's places around the country that have legislatively restricted the requirement for sprinklers in single-family homes and townhomes. And they look at costs, which they do add a little bit of cost, but that's more on the retrofit side when we're coming in, you know, and helping use my experience with fire and working with the Home Fire Sprinkler Coalition, as well as being on codes committees with the International Code Council, of trying to help educate on the costs and the benefits where, you know, rebuilding, we look at Lahaina or other areas that have burnt down post-wildfire, and we want to get everyone back into their homes and back to living as normal of a life as possible, but we also don't want it to happen again. And as we are talking of building materials and things that we're putting in our homes are more prone to burn, even though they have all the testing, like they may wait a little bit longer before they ignite, but then there's a bunch of plastic, so our homes burn faster, creating less time for us to get out. And then with the building-to-building structure ignition that we see in high winds, we need to make sure that we're doing building spacing properly, or at least if we want buildings closer together, we have to accommodate for that and make sure we're using the right materials. So,
I don't know how the structure is over there in Arizona. You're the first fire marshal, I believe, in 50 years here. So how do you see working with the fire councils and the counties as well, pulling everybody together? Yeah.
I think you nailed it right there, is pulling everybody together. For me, the state fire marshal should be the hub to bring all of the different spokes in the wheel together, to break down silos or build bridges that maybe were a little shaky and solidify those relationships, but also to bring to the table what, you know, maybe a county doesn't need a certain tool every day, but then that one-off happens, and it happens throughout all the islands where maybe the state fire marshal's office houses that equipment, so it's for the benefit of everyone, versus those additional costs, or providing standardized training certifications so that we're interchangeable across the islands, but we're also helping take some of the weight off of the State Fire Council. So in 1978, when that was created, once the fire marshal's office was done away with, those fire chiefs have now been running their own fire departments, but then they've absorbed the responsibilities of state fire marshal in addition to everything else that they're supposed to be doing. And as the codes have evolved and life changes and the risks have been increasing, and now they're trying to balance those hats. So I really see it as taking a lot of weight off of their shoulders to be able to help take that community risk reduction, life safety, fire prevention aspect, and let them go manage their departments and really work with them to make sure that we're all working together.
Was there anything that surprised you, you know, going out to Nanakuli and seeing the fires there on the west side, or probably heard so much about the Lahaina fires, and then we had the Marco Polo building here in Honolulu, which, you know, driving home the whole idea why we need to update the buildings and the sprinkler codes and sprinkler systems in these buildings.
I guess the surprise is how many daily brush fires that we have, and thankfully they don't get to the size that we saw on the West Coast, Southwest, and thousands of acres that go on for campaign level days. But they're very busy here in terms of the wildfire brush fires, but they're good at getting to them and keeping them relatively contained and knocked down pretty quick. But I guess for me, being fire buff and always being in the fire service, I kept track of kind of what was going on. So I would hear fires here and there, but the story that the rest of the country or the world isn't hearing is really what all of the islands are doing here in terms of not only fighting the fires, but what they're trying to do and trying to bring everybody to the table for mitigation and resilience to try to not have another Lahaina. And one of my missions is to make sure that we do everything in our power to prevent that, but in the event that it does happen, is making sure that we're advocating for the support to rebuild so it doesn't happen again.
You mentioned you come from a family of firefighters. What is it about going out there and protecting a community that you've seen your relatives do?
I mean, I don't know anything other than being like a servant to the community, really. I mean, my dad was a firefighter, retired as a battalion chief in Peoria, Illinois. My grandfather worked with the fire department as well. My mom was a teacher. So everybody in my family has been ingrained into helping the community and helping others. So it was a natural fit for me to end up serving in some capacity. And oddly enough, my dad had tried to talk me out of the fire service for a long time just because he didn't want me to have the hazards and the stresses that he had seen. And by my senior year, he finally gave up on it. But going to school for fire protection engineering, and then also in the military, just there's always been a servitude attitude of wanting to take care of others and give back.
What'd your dad say when you told him you were going to be Hawaii's fire marshal?
I can't say that on air, but no, it was kind of a mixed bag of emotions, and obviously super ecstatic for me, but also sad because I'm moving even further away. So my entire family was in Illinois, being 2,000 miles away. You could at least get in a car and drive 24 hours and be there, and flights were pretty easy to get. Now going almost 5,000 miles away from them is tough, and I'm a daddy's girl. Like, there is no denying that one. Even when I came in and my first day, he goes, I really wanted to be there. I'm like, I know, but because swearing in ceremonies are huge in the fire service, and it just happened differently here. And that was trying to explain to him, you didn't miss much. You did, but you didn't. It's like, at least when they come out, hopefully we're working on February-ish around my birthday to bring the family out. And we can reenact a little bit of it, but
well, we certainly appreciate you taking the time out and letting us get to know you a little bit better.
Thank you. And I'm here, like, as we were just talking about, to serve the community. If there's things that I can do to really help improve based on my experiences and knowledges, that's what I'm here for. But I will say that I'm still building the office, and I have a staff of me, myself, and I, so we're working through that. And the fire departments here are fantastic. So they should be truly the first line of effort in calling in concerns and things and working with the counties. And I'm here to help them and the community, but we really have to work on those lines of effort so I can get the office established. And then also, I'm not here to take away from what the counties are already doing. So that community relationship with their neighbors is very important to me. So I'm here to help, and I'll bring people together, but ultimately, you know, it's like we're one big community. We're working towards a fire adaptive community, a state where all parties have their own kuleana, and we want to put those together for longevity.
Well, thank you and welcome.
Thank you.
Now, that was a very humble Dory Booth, Hawaii's new fire marshal, who is marking 2 months on the job as we approach 2 years since the Maui wildfires. For today's Manu Minute, we've got the call of the pueo, Hawaii's only native owl. Collectively, it has one of the most extensive ranges in the avian world. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart with your Manu Minute.
Pueo, or Hawaiian short-eared owl, is our only native owl and is important in Hawaiian culture as an aumakua. Pueo are active mainly during the day, unlike the more common barn owl, which is mostly seen at night and has a striking white face. Pueo spend a majority of their time soaring over open grassy areas hunting for small mammals such as mice and rats. They're doing well on most of the Hawaiian islands, but it's becoming more difficult to hear the call of the pueo on Oahu, where they're considered an endangered subspecies. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, supporting their communities, habitats, and wildlife. More about helping at friendsofoahunwr.org.
Next month marks 80 years since the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan, which ended the war in the Pacific. August 6th is when Hiroshima was hit. 3 days later, Nagasaki was also bombed. Mayor Rick Blangiardi is traveling to Japan to mark the occasion in Hiroshima, Honolulu's oldest sister city. And here in Hawaii, there'll be an event at the Waikiki Natatorium on August 6th, just a week from today. It's part of what's called the Renkon Project. Renkon is the word for lotus root in Japanese. A familiar voice joins us to share more about what's planned. Noe Tanigawa is a former culture and arts reporter for HPR, and she's inviting the public to come down to Waikiki, where lotus and war images will grace the walls of the natatorium to commemorate the 1945 bombings. Noe invited us to her art studio, where a mock-up of the Natatorium is center stage.
And so tell us how this Rincon project got started, because when I think of Lotus, I think of, you know, enlightenment and clarity of thinking. And so what inspired this project?
So cool, Catherine. You already know something. You bring something to the project knowing that much about Lotus, you know, because it's this project started with Lotus. I mean, I've been raising them and drawing them since the 1980s, and I just love them I love them visually, I love them physically, I love the fragrance of them, and I'd love to spread Lotus culture to people. And you were just talking about the kind of the symbolism of them. And so this started out with a vision of projecting pink lotus onto my family's Buddhist temple, which is the Jodo Mission in Makiki, just off the freeway. I thought, I had this vision of trying to do that. So we started talking about it. Then I wanted to mix in some dancers. And I thought of Butoh dancers, that indigenous Japanese dance form that grew out of a response to the atomic bomb experience. And that, you cannot discuss Butoh without thinking about where it comes from, the bomb experience that now is 80 years ago. Every art project is an educational journey, but that's what started a deeper dive for me in learning so much more about World War II. Catherine, I mean, I went through it in high school, college a little maybe, but now it's fascinating looking at how it started in Europe. The resonances, the same words being used. And here in the United States and even in Hawaii, people are, it's again seeping kind of into our culture in ways that, wow, we could take note of. So that's one part of it. That's sort of like the mud I feel that lotus, the roots of lotus grow in, right? And Rincon means lotus root in Japanese. And you know when you cut it crosswise? Have you ever seen it?
Yes, I have a lotus plant.
Yeah, you know what it looks like, right? There are holes. At New Year's time, we make foods out of the Rincon, the lotus root, because you can see the past through those holes and you can see the future. It's part of the lotus journey. And some of the propaganda and the sort of desensitizing that goes on that prepares people. I guess it prepares us by making us afraid, but it prepares us to do things that we didn't think we could or ever would do. And I think that's kind of what happened in World War II. It's not to look back at history and try to find wrong and right or anything. It's to try to understand at every point the human decisions that were made. And I respect the film Oppenheimer that came out for painting a vivid picture of one aspect of the atomic bomb, but there are other parts of the story. And that, well, I started working with a cadre of artists that we decided to take it on and see what we could add to the story.
And so you traveled to Hiroshima to understand better their part of this whole experience. And what was that like for you?
I think of people who visit us in Hawaii and they come to feel the feeling of aloha, and they do feel it. There are certain times of day, of course, places you can be, people you can meet that where you feel it more, but there's a feeling there. We went to Hiroshima, Jody Stillwater, a filmmaker from Bay Area, and Vince Bercasio, a filmmaker from here in Honolulu. We went, I guess, hoping to find the story to tell today, hoping to find what we could identify with there. We don't go in, no one goes into a place like that blind. We've all heard things over the years. We've seen anime and historical films, all kinds of things dealing with the subject. But to go there and really try to experience it on a human, almost physical level was, I'm so thankful that I could go there with these two creatives. You know, part of this project is Catherine. I met so many incredible people in the time I worked at HPR, great artists in this community. You know, a good number of them are involved in this project, and so great to work with them. But the idea is to make it so that creatives can work in Hawaii. you know, they can be paid for what they do somehow. We're watching it happen right now in the film industry where people are pulling together because Hawaii's got an edge on this. Creativity, culture, and I think health and wellness are areas that we can excel in and bring together.
And so this project, you're bringing these different aspects. You've got the dance, you'll have the film, the imagery that will be projected on the natatorium walls.
I'm kind of wanting to warn people a little about that imagery because this is not any kind of imagery that we would ever have projected on a temple or anything like that. This has evolved because, as I was discussing the original idea with Marian Kadora, who's the acting executive director of the Mayor's Office of Culture and the Arts here in Honolulu, she said, you know, with the city, we really want to work with artists. We don't have a lot of money to fund you, but we love it when you use our facilities. And I think, oh, wow, what, like where? And she said, we were sitting right across from the water supply building, that beautiful green building on Barataria. I mean, and then she said, what about that building in Waikiki? And I thought, oh my gosh, the Natatorium War Memorial. And it grew out of that conversation. And it has been so terrific working with the city on this idea. You know, Laura Thielen there, Brett Fisher in the parks, really working together to make this happen. And I thank the city for Lay Day. I thank the city for Kamehameha Parade. I thank the city for so many things that so many people today really haven't made the time for. But, you know, let's recommit to some of these things that Honolulu City provides for us and turn out. And this is one of them. And it's going to be free at a beautiful time of day.
Well, I think, you know, it's been called, what, an immersive experience, right? So it's not a traditional film with interviews and that kind of thing. It's more of a feeling.
You got it, Catherine. And we're setting the evening up for you. We have people from theater helping to stage this so that it'll be an event outdoors and an immersive experience, as you said. It's going to start with, and we're bringing people back from the dead. It's the right season. It's Obong. We're bringing people back from the dead to help with this project. Mark Izu, a dear musician, jazz musician from the Bay Area, is going to open up with playing show, a strange Japanese pan flute. And Laurie Otani, a terrific Butoh artist here in Honolulu, passed in 2020. We've never had a chance to really salute her. Many of her students and others here in the community are celebrating her on that occasion as well. And Hiroko Tamano, master Butoh dancer since the 1970s, is coming to town. We believe that there are a lot of things, stories we tell ourselves in our heads about our terrific individualities. But you know, 99.8% of all of us human beings is the same physically. And going back to our physical bodies, I think, is going to be a great way to find some commonality going forward. So we've got these 3 days of Butoh workshops that Hiroko is going to come to town and do. I hear they're 3 hours each day. We've made it so that people working can come. It's after work on a Friday, then Saturday and Sunday, and it's 3-hour immersion into these processes that they develop to work through anxieties like the atomic bomb anxiety, but I mean, we've got a lot of anxieties and people walking around with their shoulders up to their ear. I don't know what this experience is going to be like, Catherine, but we want people to go through it. And then at the Natatorium, Hiroko will perform and we'll see what kind of spirits we can raise.
With some help from Kenny Endo as well.
Yes, and Bishop Ishikawa from Jodo Mission, Kahu Radiakau from Moanalua will also be there with us. Meliana Meyer will contribute an ahu for that occasion there because it is a memorial to those who perished in World War I. So it's going to be a terrific night to all be together, and I really would like to salute all the artists, you know, the key artists that I've been working with, Jody Stillwater, Vincent Percasio, you got to talk to him. And Alex Singer, projection artist. Projection is a whole other thing. And he's working this building, people. I really want you to come down and check this out. Kenny Endo, master, will be there with his team. And you know this is a huge week for Kenny, his 50th anniversary. He's got a team in town. He'll be here at the Natatorium with us. Pei Ling Kao, a dancer for today and tomorrow. terrific dancer. Hiroko will be there. Taiji Terasaki has contributed some visual effects as well. And you're going to see the natatorium, I think, be transfigured. Maybe we'll just manage to dematerialize it completely. I don't know.
But it will be an experience to remember.
I hope so, Catherine. That was Noitani Gawa, who we talked to earlier this week. And, you know, we did get a chance to chat with the filmmaker whose images will grace the walls of the Natatorium War Memorial. Tanigawa and Vince Procaccio visited the Hiroshima Peace Memorial in Japan, where dignitaries will gather on August 6th. The current fragile geopolitical world tensions is something that Procaccio wants to underscore.
I hope that it is more than something that just has viewers reflecting and pondering. Like, now is the time to act. Like, war is still happening. The suffering you will see on the screen, none of that's gone. None of that is hidden in the past. There's a quote from the film Night and Fog by Alain René, and the film ends with a quote, which is a little paraphrased, but it goes like, you think the old monsters are buried under the rubble, like the concentration camps, even though the buildings are torn down, like the monster is still there. Like, you think this is behind you and it's not. And I would like viewers to take that away with them. None of this is over. And there is no legacy of peace without reflecting on the current moment. The peace is not here. And viewers must act in whatever way they can to preserve that so-called peace.
Peace and war. This has been a story of a memorial, of memorials to peace and war. These political times certainly provide a powerful, provocative backdrop for the commemoration. Look for links to all the events scheduled for the Rincon Project on our website after the show. And we leave you with a preview of what's to expect for the commemoration at the Natatorium War Memorial a week from today.
Support for HPR comes from Waimea Valley on Oahu. Its summer concert series finale features Pomai and Friends, the Hawaiian Style Band, and others August 30th. Tickets at waimeavalley.net.
It's the live show you've been waiting for. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is coming to Honolulu in October. Our ticket presale for HPR members begins August 6th. Make sure you're ready. Get details at hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait. Sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners.
Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
What you just heard was a chant used by the late musician Fiji to begin each of his performances. It's been a week since he died, and his passing triggered a flood of tributes on social media. HPR's culture and arts reporter Cassie Ordonio joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
It was a very beautiful song, and also it's the fact that Fiji was so embedded into his culture that he has about maybe 9-10 albums, and he would always start with either a Fijian chant or a song just to honor his culture. And yeah, it's been 1 week since his passing. We don't know how he passed away. That hasn't been announced yet. But many people remember Fiji growing up with his music and describing his album as a soundtrack of their lives. And many have described Fiji as humble and has this powerful stage presence, especially when he's performing live. And his first album, Evolution, we get to hear this blend of how much of he was the pioneer of the Pacific. He did reggae, jazz, hip-hop, and R&B. With my love, So you really get to kind of hear that diversity. That song, Nice and Easy, came from his first album, in the 1994 Evolution. And that was kind of like that old school R&B hip hop that you just heard before he transitioned over to reggae music. And there's an interview that Fiji did about a decade ago with Fela Talks, and Fiji said he always felt this weight of responsibility to represent the Pacific, not just as a Fijian, but as an indigenous Pacific Islander. He always wanted to sing from the depth of his soul rather than just produce another lovey-dovey song, but he always stayed true to himself rather than selling out as a musical product in mainstream media. And when he sang his songs, he always wanted to address indigenous people in the Pacific, their rights, their culture, and language. And he said during that interview that he was going, that was going to be his mission till the end of his life. So Fiji is born with the name George Brooks Veycoso, but close family members would call him Joji. Actually spoke with his cousin, who was a very much of a rascal to him. He was a backup singer. His name is Siausi, who I've interviewed. I got to learn more about Fiji through him. And Fiji was actually raised by a single mother in the housing settlement of Raiwanga. And he turned to music to mend his broken heart. His love for music came from being from a broken family. His father, his biological father, was never around, so a single mother was raising him along with his other aunties and uncles. And he moved to Hawaii in 1987, and before he launched his solo career, he was actually in Hawaiian style band. He sang part of the lead and backup to Rhythm of the Ocean. Fiji also came from a musical family. One of his uncles was a legendary musician who did the Fiji classics, and another uncle actually worked on Elvis Presley's song, Drums of the Island. He did the English interpretation. Hmm. And Fiji has been like this the successful artist. He released 10 solo albums. His musical output has even earned him awards like Hawaii's Nahoku Hanohano Award for Male Vocalist of the Year, Favorite Entertainer of the Year, and People's Choice Awards. And his collaboration on Island Warriors' compilation album earned him a Grammy nomination for Best Reggae Album. And he's even spoiled local artist Kimie Minor. She says Fiji was a mentor to her, and says other artists as well was mentored by Fiji, like Common Kings, J-Boog, Maoli, and so much more. And she says her favorite memory with Fiji was when they were doing laundry together.
I thought, like, this is crazy. I'm doing laundry with Fiji, and we're just, he's sharing all this mana'o with me about the music industry. One thing he always told me is the music industry has nothing to do with music and everything to do with rights. Make sure you take care of your rights, you know, like your intellectual property. And, you know, I was 19, 20 years old, like, okay, whatever, you know, but it stayed with me for the past 20 years of just remembering his wisdom and his guidance in this music industry. And he was someone who was authentically himself. He sang and spoke from his soul.
That's great that he really mentored a lot of up-and-coming musicians.
He did. And his passing came just about a month before he was supposed to do the homecoming festival in Fiji. He did one last year. That was, I believe it was his first. That's when he would go home back to his home country in Fiji and just perform all of his classics along with the folks he mentored, like J-Boog. And I also got an update from the homecoming. Right now, it's been put on pause. Right now, they want to respect his family and the mourning of his and the loss of Fiji. So they kind of put that that on pause until further notice. The festival was supposed to be in September. But the people who I interviewed, actually, I even got to interview Roby Kahakalau, who sang Love and Honesty and was in Hawaiian-style band. And she said that Fiji was very instrumental in shaping her career as well. A lot of people don't know this. He sang backup for Hawaiian-style bands, but not just backup. He produced the music. He was helping coach her. And Roby described him as someone who was so versatile in different languages. He spoke Fijian, Tongan, Samoan, and she said even German as well. But even if he wasn't fluent, he would always make sure that he has the people who spoke it fluently to help him enunciate. She said he had this photographic memory of how to enunciate different words as he was singing in these various languages.
So it's, he took great care.
He did. He really, really did. And not only that, he keeps inspiring younger generations of Pacific Islander musicians. I spoke with Reno Onowai. He was actually an American Idol and credits Fiji for inspiring him to even apply for this this show.
His music not only created inspiration for us, but it reminded us that it's okay to be authentically ourselves and show up as ourselves in spaces where we don't see us. It's okay to author our stories the way we do and produce our music the way our people do. He knocked down the doors for us and created a community where we had none. To go back to my first experience with Uncle Fiji, I actually grew up on all of his albums, but the first song that really, really tugged at my heart was Where Did We Go Wrong? It's really acoustic, so we can really hear the rawness and the emotion of Uncle Fiji. A lot of his music was uplifting and upbeat, rooted in island reggae, but that one really pulled back so we can hear the rawness of his emotion. And what that song did for me was it validated my want and need to be more vulnerable in music. He broke down the stereotypes of toxic masculinity and was always vulnerable with the way he shared his story. So I'll appreciate that forever.
I also spoke with local DJ by Alefosio. She said she's been playing Fiji's music the whole entire week. I just saw her on social media. She was actually at one of our local malls in Kahala playing Fiji music. And she says Fiji reminds her of the late Tongan scholar Apeliha Ofa because his music connects Pacific Islanders from various regions of the ocean.
I think all of us are so deeply impacted by his death is because it felt like he's just a Pacific Islander musician who spoke to all of us, regardless of what your ethnic or racial background was, in Oceania. And he sang so many songs in different Pacific Island nations, too. He sang music in Tongan, he sang music in Samoan, in Fijian, in English, and a few other, you know, dialects, too. But it just made you feel like you were a part of something bigger than just yourself.
Well, thank you so much for sharing his story.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Yeah. Well, we have been hearing from HPR's Cassie Ordonio. She was talking about the life and work of the musician Fiji, who died last week. Well, we have run out of time, but up tomorrow, it is touch and go for a local hub for climate research. We learn what's at stake. Were you caught up in the tsunami snarl? Share your experience on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere you tune in for podcasts. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation. Very first time.